This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hey, it's Brad. And the more I hear about midterm elections this year, the more it feels like we can all sometimes fall into this trap of taking certain issues for granted, right? Like crime. We've been talking all week about how crime has become a central talking point on the campaign trail, how a lot of that crime talk goes back to 2020 when Americans felt out of control. Defund the police became this rallying cry for the far left, then a boogeyman for the far right. But remember what people were actually saying when they discussed defunding the police. Largely, they were wondering what would happen if we took a small sliver of public funds and devoted it to groups that do something a little more specialized than the cops. Like, what would happen if you used police less in schools or hospitals, or in a country where people with untreated mental illness are 16 times more likely to be killed by law enforcement? What if police weren't the first call when someone might be going through mental distress? Well, whether you knew it or not, some communities have actually tried this. They've gone ahead with it. They've rolled out new programs. They've hired new staffs. And so a few months ago, our producer, Madeline Wood, came to me and said, are these measures working, like, at all? She said, I live near one of them. I can find out. And so today, that's what we have for you. The latest in our series of reports where the Start Here team dives into one topic for the whole show to explore a story you only think you've heard before. With that, I'm going to hand it off to Madeline.
So the police stopped on the corner of this road, just where I'm about to turn in. So they got the call. They must have come here, and then this is where they planned sort of their course of action.
I'm on a sunny, leafy street in Walnut Creek, California, a Bay Area suburb about 20 miles from San Francisco and 15 miles from Oakland. Around here, Walnut Creek is known for its high-end shopping, like Tiffany's and Nordstrom. It's not the kind of place you think of when you think of police violence, but that's why I'm here.
So I know I'm at the right house because there's the Justice for Miles Hall sign, and it's like half Black Lives Matter, and then it's got sort of a picture of Miles Hall on his bike, but the other one is a school picture, and he's sort of wearing this black jumper, and he's looking right at the camera, and he's smiling, and yeah, he looks like a normal teenager.
I'm here to meet Tawn Hall. Her son Miles was killed a street away from their home by police in 2019. He was going through a mental health crisis. And I'm here to figure out what happens when you have a loved one struggling with mental illness and your only option is to call 911. What happens when you do everything by the book, put your trust in law enforcement to keep you and your loved one safe, and they completely let you down? From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Madeline Wood.
Yeah, and then that picture over there was Scott, my husband, gave that to me a year after Miles was killed for Mother's Day. Wow. And, you know, it's just a picture from his, when he graduated from high school. Mm-hmm. And it's just, you know, it's all painted red and it's just like, just a beautiful kind of depiction of Miles, of who he is.
Tawn Hall is reserved, but friendly. She tells me about her son Miles as she shows me pictures and mementos of him. She's spoken to lots of people about him, and when she talks about him, she sounds like any other mum. Proud.
And just those blue eyes, blue-green eyes, and that smile.
Yeah.
That smile. It's just the essence of Miles, you know? Just, he was true beauty.
As a kid, Tawn says Miles' teachers loved him. She says he was never a troublemaker in school or at home.
He just never went through, like, the lying stage, or he was just really genuine, just like a nice person.
He was creative. He started making his own rap beats in seventh grade, and then he was onto instruments a few years later. Here's Miles playing the keyboard.
So then he picked up, oh, I'm going to learn how to play the piano. So he just learned how to play the piano one day. He was really smart.
So tell me when you first started thinking he might be experiencing something out with the normal like issues people have growing up. When were you first like, oh, this might need somebody else to talk to him about?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely started seeing things in high school. He was more withdrawn. He didn't want to like go to school. He didn't want to go to class. So first, you know, you think depression, right? Okay, he's depressed. And then right around graduation, like I was like, what are your plans? And he was like, oh, well, God's going to provide for me. We're not super religious people. So that was a little different for him to say. And then he started really reading the Bible. And then he started like preaching to people.
Miles started sending text messages to friends and family that just didn't seem like him. Really long and out of the blue, sending them to people he hadn't talked to in a long time. Again, with lots of references to Jesus and the Bible. Then, he began telling the family he was Jesus, and eventually telling neighbours, knocking on their doors and preaching.
And, you know, he is African-American. We're an African-American family. So I was concerned because we live in more of a white area. So, I was, you know, it's just concerned that people would be, like, concerned, or especially because he doesn't look like them, right?
Eventually, Miles would be diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder. But in the beginning, without an official diagnosis, Tawn knew she needed help. She started seeing a therapist to figure out how to navigate this new Miles. She found a group called NAMI, National Alliance on Mental Illness, and took their 12-week course on signs and symptoms of various illnesses like schizophrenia, OCD, bipolar, and she was recognizing some of the symptoms in Miles.
And one thing they had mentioned was just make sure you like partner with the local law enforcement. So I was like, okay, well, I wouldn't have thought about that, but okay, that's a possibility, I guess, just to make sure they knew who Miles was. And so that's what I did.
And that's when the Hall family began their 3 years plus relationship with the local police department, starting when Miles was around 20 years old. Tawn wanted to be proactive. She wanted to keep Miles safe. She trusted that if officers got to know Miles, understood his illness and saw his humanity, that they wouldn't approach him with aggression. But she knew there were risks in inviting police into the situation too, especially given that he was black. Studies show that black people are 2 or even 3 times more likely to be killed by police in this country, even in instances where they pose little to no threat.
I understand that African-American people have a higher rate of being shot by the police, right? But I was like, okay, if they know him, they're going to respond with care and compassion because...
Walnut Creek police say they had numerous encounters with Miles over the years. Mental health evaluations, petty thefts, and threats against family and neighbours, a claim Tawn denies. Even still, according to the police's own characterisation, his background amounted to, quote, not a significant criminal history.
You can see the deterioration, but you can't do anything to help them. So that was very hard because he's an adult, and it was just really, there just wasn't really any options for help.
Miles didn't recognize he was ill, so he didn't want to pursue psychiatric help. And he was over 18, so no one could force him. But one incident in 2018 led to Miles being hospitalized without his consent, under the California legal code 5150. But it involved police and handcuffs and charges from the DA.
And then he went to residential facility and he was given an injectable medicine. And that's what we noticed, like night and day, like a big difference. Now he was motivated to go to school. He wanted to get a job. He wanted a girlfriend, friends. He wasn't isolated anymore. So we were super hopeful. But, you know, anytime you're involving the police when you need help, you're criminalizing that child.
Tawn says that he got one more dose when he got home, but that was his last. Even still, for the next 8 months, things were pretty normal. But by mid-2019, when Miles was 23, he was showing signs of his mental illness creeping back. And so on June 1st, Tawn reached out to Walnut Creek PD's mental health officer, a woman who'd been her contact from early on.
She didn't answer, but I left her a message saying, hey, it looks like, you know, looks like Miles is showing signs again.
Tawn also called the non-emergency number to let them know Miles was declining. And the next day...
Miles is, he's gardening outside. He's taking on gardening with his grandma. And one of my neighbors next door was like, hey, Miles, looks like you're having a hard time with that gardening. Hey, here's a tool.
Tawn says the neighbor gave him a gardening tool, a long metal rod, sort of like a crowbar. Miles starts calling it his staff from God.
So he's walking around the house with his garden tool, and he's just, you know, talking about how he's Jesus, and he's, but he's a little more agitated than normal. So my husband and I were sitting in our bedroom, and we have a big sliding glass door, and Miles is outside, and then all of a sudden he breaks the window with this garden tool, and he comes in, and he asks us all to leave, me and my husband, and he says, you know, this is his house, and he's God, and we ended up, me and my husband and my mom ended up leaving the house because we were also not trying to escalate him, because especially he had asked us to leave, and we were trying to de-escalate the situation.
Were you scared?
I was scared, yeah. I mean, my door was broken, right? So I was scared because he's never been aggressive to break anything. So this is definitely, this is not a normal behavior for him. So I'm scared. I'm scared not for myself more so, I'm scared for him. He's really declining, obviously, quickly. So we leave the house, and so then that's when I call 911.
911 emergency.
Hi, yes.
What's going on there?
We need to have police at our house.
What's police happening?
He's being violent. He broke our sliding glass window. He's threatening us with it.
And just like she'd learned from her NAMI course, Tawn tells the 911 operator about his mental health issues and that he was carrying a metal rod.
He's going to be aggressive to the police. And he needs to be apprehended. He cannot be in our house. He has to go.
So Tawn hangs up the phone and waits.
So I think maybe about 10 minutes later, one of my neighbors calls me, and that's when she tells me he's been shot. So my neighbor next door, she's screaming on the phone, you know, Tawn, you know, Miles has been shot. And then I guess a couple minutes later, the officer calls me, and she's frantic. She's crying, and Miles has been shot. I was like, is he alive? She's like, just go.
According to police reports, officers responded to various calls that afternoon. Not just from Tawn, but from several neighbours too, reporting screams from the hall home and saying Miles was pounding on a neighbour's door. Officers arrive on the scene at 4:52 p.m. The mental health officer gets there a few minutes later, but not in enough time to de-escalate. There's video of the scene from a neighbourhood surveillance camera and several body cams on the officers at the scene. In the footage, you can see the police officers approaching Miles. They're yelling his name, telling him to come here. He yells back. Miles starts running in their direction, but past them. Police say he was running at them. Tawn says he was trying to run home. He has the metal pry bar in his hands. They're shouting at him to stop. He keeps running, and they shoot. The officers first fire a beanbag round, meant to stop a suspect, but not do permanent damage. When that doesn't stop Miles, officers shoot him several times with their handguns.
So we get to the hospital, and I was praying, you know, he was going to be alive, right? Praying that maybe they shot him in a place where it didn't cause the damage, and, I mean, he would be alive. And 15 minutes later, they call us in a room, and... like, we're so sorry. And, you know, officer is there, and she's just, first thing she says to me is, you guys, you know, we're like the model family. You know, I'm so sorry this happened, and you did everything right. I was like, are you kidding me? Like, how can we be the model family? My son is dead.
An internal investigation by Walnut Creek Police cleared the officers. 12 days after Miles was killed, they were eligible to go back on patrol. Tawn will always have to live with the fact that she was one of the ones to call 911 that day.
How did it feel that you had called 911?
I mean, obviously it feels awful that he's dead at the hands of police. And it's awful that we're part of that phone call. I mean, it's devastating. And that's something I can't ever change.
Tawn feels the system failed at various points along the way. Mental health resources weren't visible or accessible enough. Getting Miles help without his consent meant an arrest. And in her mind, police came to the scene with implicit anti-black bias. But most importantly for Tawn was the fact that the police responded to a mental health crisis with violence. Walnut Creek Police said in a statement to ABC that Miles's death was, quote, a tragedy that we all wished hadn't happened. And since his death, the department provided officers with training specific to mental health crisis. And this year, all officers attended a course in de-escalation and tactical conduct. We reached out to the mental health officer that Tawn worked with over the years, and she told us, quote, it's not that I blame anyone, but the way this situation unfolded was a nightmare that everyone involved has to live with. For Tawn, she's taken her pain to purpose. She and her family have tried to seek justice for Miles, and they filed a federal civil rights lawsuit against Walnut Creek Police. They ended up reaching a settlement of $4 million. But the county DA did an independent investigation and concluded the officers involved in Miles' shooting acted in self-defense and defense of others. They decided not to prosecute. Tawn's efforts in the courts have stalled, but she's found success with local government. She's been working with her assemblywomen on solutions, how to make sure what happened to her son never happens to anyone else.
She was like, what would you have needed the day, you know, he was killed? And I said, we needed a different number to call. We needed a different response. A response that's caring, compassionate, isn't dangerous. They don't come with guns because they don't need to come with guns.
So can you build a system like that? One that creates radically different endings to this story? One that stops mental health calls going to police by default? Well, one city, just up the road from Tawn, is trying. And that's where we're going. After the break.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Have you ever wondered what you would do with an extra hour in your day? I think about this all the time. I'm like, I would be so productive. I'd exercise more, or I'd read a book, or I'd take a nap, like restore myself. We often find ourselves yearning for these extra hours, but the real question is, what would you do if you were making yourself a priority? Well, how about therapy? It can help you discover what's important so you can make the most of your time. If you've ever benefited from therapy, you know how transformative it can be. It's not just for those who have experienced major trauma. Therapy empowers you to learn positive coping skills, set boundaries, and become the best version of yourself. If you're considering starting therapy, you should give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and tailored to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire. You'll be matched with a licensed therapist. And here's the beauty of it. You can switch therapists if you're not finding the right fit. No additional charge. Take the first step. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/start here today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/start here. With daylight saving time upon us, we're looking forward to more daylight and longer days from March through November. And while setting our clocks forward gives us the illusion of more time, it doesn't necessarily help businesses find qualified candidates any sooner. Fear not, there is a solution. ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter is your 24/7 hiring partner working tirelessly to connect you with the right candidate. Once you post your job on ZipRecruiter, it gets distributed to over 100 job sites, ensuring you reach a diverse pool of qualified individuals. Their smart technology scans thousands of resumes, matching you with people whose skills perfectly align with your job requirements. Spring forward with a new hiring partner, ZipRecruiter, and find top talent sooner. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address to try ZipRecruiter for free, ZipRecruiter.com/start here. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/start here. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
No, we're going to go over there first. What'd you see? A tarp and somebody under, potentially.
Just 15 minutes away from Ton's home in Walnut Creek is Oakland, California. It's nearly 9 a.m. on a chilly October morning, and I'm out on patrol with Jazz, who's an EMT, and Kiara, a crisis intervention specialist. It's Kiara who spotted a sleeping person lying out on the pavement, wrapped up in a thin blue blanket. They look like a mummy, the blanket stretched around them to ward off the chill.
I'm going to leave the car running, and you can leave your window down if you want.
Good morning, it's Macro. Hi. Are you in there?
Kiara and Jazz work for Macro, which stands for Mobile Assistance Community Responders of Oakland. Beginning in April of 2022, Macro rolled out a pilot program that aims to respond to low-level calls instead of police. Imagine those calls that make you hesitate before you dial 911, that make you wonder if this is the right place to ask for help. These are the calls Macro takes about mental health, homelessness, behavioral concerns.
We'll be waking her up. She'd be mad as well.
For a second, there's no movement. Then the person wriggles a little. It's a woman they've seen before. She doesn't want anything, she says. She just wants to be left alone.
You have a good day, okay?
She seems annoyed, and she pulls the blanket tighter.
You said you knew her? You said you've seen her before?
Yeah.
She doesn't like to be woken up. She can be a little agitated.
She's mostly very agitated, but unfortunately, it's a part of our job that we have to do.
This is Jazz, the EMT.
We have had people, unfortunately, that were not sleeping. Exactly. They were unconscious most of the time. It's an overdose, and you know the call immediately changes. It's important to check on every single person that appears to be sleeping, because you don't know. You never know, and it seems trivial and slightly cruel, but it's something that we really have to do, because there are, I believe, 6 people at this point whose lives we have saved.
Yeah.
Because people assumed that they were asleep, and they were not.
And calls like these have another function. They can often prevent the police or an ambulance being called. The sleeping person was okay. If she had wanted help, the team could have met her basic needs and moved on.
Do you guys hang out outside of work?
I hang out with her outside of work.
just her.
Honestly. No.
That's Kiara talking about Jazz. Kiara's tall, and she says she looks tough until she opens her mouth. Jazz is shorter, with long purple braids. And together, they make up a Macro unit. Each of these teams has an EMT, a crisis intervention specialist, and a minivan packed with supplies.
Do you ever run through like a worst case scenario in your head of like violence or...
Oh, yeah.
Is that something you think about?
Oh, every scenario is a possibility.
Yeah.
So you saw how far back we were when we approached. until we heard her voice, because we don't know who it is. We don't know what they have under the blanket. We don't know if it's a person that's known to be violent. So yeah. We kept our distance.
Oakland has struggled with a reputation as being a dangerous city. High violent crime rates, understaffed police, crime waves many cities saw during the pandemic, they've left scars here. And whenever Oakland is hurting, people in East Oakland feel it first. There's a lower life expectancy here, lower access to healthcare, higher numbers of shootings and homicides. And East Oakland is where Jazz and Kiara are working today.
Staying out of arm's reach, especially in blind situations like that, is one of the most important things, because a lot of the weapons that people have here, out here, are not guns. Yeah. Most of them aren't. So they have to be
near. So they're knives?
They're knives, bats. Had a guy with a chainsaw.
Machetes.
One of those.
Macro isn't the police. It was an agency created to be separate from the police on purpose, because there's a history of mistrust between Oakland police and public. If any of these interactions gets out of hand, if it turns violent or they need backup, they can use their radio to ask for assistance from the fire department or police. But Jazz and Kiara try to avoid that. They feel it would erode the careful trust they're trying to build with the community. This is a norm to them. And Macro offers something very different from a usual first response unit. They're not armed, they can't detain anyone or force them to do anything. They can just offer resources. Places people can go for temporary housing, or counselling, or further medical referral. If they need medical attention on the spot, Jazz has the basics for on-site care and assessment. They're not there to replace police, but the service frees up the police to put their focus elsewhere, like violent crime. It's more like a pre-first response, trying to get people the help they need before their moment of crisis. A guiding principle in creating this program was making sure that it met the needs of Oakland. It had to focus on mental health issues, but also the social problems that go along with it. Homelessness, mistrust of authorities, drug use. So there are two ways that Macro teams can get involved in cases. The first is by calling 911, where you can request Macro services. They have a special dispatch centre, ready to take diverted calls that might otherwise go to police. The other way is what Jazz and Kiara do all morning during my shift with them. They see someone who needs help, and they go to them.
So have you just seen someone there?
Yes, she's a regular.
But she's awake and up and speaking to either herself or to somebody over there, but she knows who we are.
We're in deep East Oakland, next to a busy road. There are plenty of cars, but few people on the street. There's trash in the gutters, on the pavement, everywhere. Kiara spotted a woman wrapped in a big pink blanket, sitting at a bus stop with a broken window.
She seems chill right now.
But like, who is she?
She's probably just in the alternate reality.
Yeah.
And that's fine.
Each tour.
Jazz radios the dispatch center our location, tells them the reason for the stop, behavioral concern, and we jump out of the van. Kiara walks over first. She's the crisis intervention specialist, and it's her turn to take the lead.
Y'all still ain't got no snacks?
I'm sorry. Well, now, y'all got
EBT. Who got EBT?
Y'all should have EBT.
I ain't got no EBT. I got some water. I got a mask, water.
The woman at the bus stop seems relaxed, happy to joke with them. She's met them before. When Jazz goes to the back of the van to fetch some water, the woman moves, as though she's about to take off the blanket.
Don't take it off. Take it off, and somebody sees, they can call the police.
If someone sees you, they could call the police on you, Kiara says. She's worried there's nothing under the blanket, which has happened before. When Jazz comes back with water, she brings a t-shirt too. As the woman puts it on, she shuffles in the blanket. We all see there's nothing underneath.
Do you need a place to get some clothes?
They offer to take her somewhere to pick up more clothes, but she declines. When Kiara and Jazz get back in the car, they're worried. They're worried that someone's going to see the woman at the bus stop, see her erratic behavior, and call the police. And that's the problem. Advocates for programs like Macro around the country say that police have been used as a kind of social work system, and they shouldn't be. It's fallen to them by default, since they're available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. But those interactions come with a cost. Put simply, contact with police increases the likelihood of escalation. And one in four victims of police violence had a mental health condition.
Welcome, Fire Macro 2.
It's nearing the end of Jazz and Kiara's shift. We're winding our way back to base, heading slowly back west.
When I started at Macro, I was actually homeless. I was living in a family shelter with my daughter. And I knew that this was the opportunity for me to get out of that shelter, which I since have.
And Jazz only started at Macro at the end of March. She's one of the original recruits of the program. But before that, when she was dotting between shelters, she would sometimes live in her car for a few days at a time.
So do you think that gives you an extra layer of empathy because you've experienced something similar?
The layers on layers on layers of empathy that I have for these people is like, it can't even be stated.
There's a lot of patience too.
Yeah.
For something that will be like, take me over the top, she would just, it doesn't do that to her.
That empathy, it's really clear when you spend time with Jazz and Kiara. Once, when Jazz was speaking to a young homeless person who was having trouble with his vision, she crouched down on the ground next to him and spoke softly. He didn't want help today. That's okay. They'd be back tomorrow. Could they leave anything with him? No? That's okay. They'll keep coming by to check. Would he think about accepting their offers of resources in the future? He would. That's great. Macro hasn't been in action long, only 6 months, so it's hard to know how effective this approach is. But programs like it are springing up all over the country. There's the STAR program in Denver, the CARE program in Chicago, the Be Heard team in New York. If you're asking why now, well, in the last few years, there's been a healthy habitat for these ideas to grow. Firstly, in 2020, we held a mirror up to police violence and didn't like what we saw.
A weekend of unrest amid calls for change
across America. On Capitol Hill, lawmakers on both sides of the aisle calling for police reform.
The word defund scared some people, but reform has had some wiggle room. And what seems to be a reform the most people can live with? How the police respond to mental health. Last year, polling showed a 70% approval rating for replacing police with trained experts in mental health emergencies. And that support was bipartisan.
That's why we designed the American Rescue Plan, not only to beat the pandemic, but to rebuild our economy, but to restore public safety. And we understood the challenge from the beginning.
Secondly, there was the American Rescue Plan, which earmarked $1.5 billion for local authorities to invest in their own alternative response units.
Oakland Fire Macro 2.
We've spent all day close to the main road that runs through East Oakland. But this last call, it's in a quieter neighbourhood.
What's her address?
We're on a street of well-kept detached houses. It's not fancy, but each house has a neat little garden in front. But there's one house that stands out from the others. The grass is yellow and patchy, and there's a shopping cart in the front yard. The porch is boarded up with plywood.
So this family, they have a family member that currently resides on the porch. She has substance use disorder and an undiagnosed mental illness. She was residing inside the house, but she was setting things on fire and breaking things. And the landlord was threatening eviction. So we're going to see if she's on the porch and check on her, see how she's feeling today.
While Jazz approaches the woman on the porch, Kiara and I stand on the pavement. Kiara warns me not to get too close to the house. The woman has been known to launch projectiles at passers-by. As we stand on the corner, a second woman approaches Kiara.
You live here? That's your sister?
She says she's the sister-in-law of the woman they've come to see.
Your husband?
She tells the team the whole neighborhood is worried. The house isn't being kept clean. The woman on the porch throws trash out on the street. She's apparently been known to set fires before, and there's a risk that the trash could spread a fire quickly through the neighborhood. The way the sister-in-law is talking, she sounds like she's at her wit's end. They've been here before, and nothing seems to help.
She could burn this whole, just all this down, simply being careless. Okay, well, we're gonna leave, get going, but we definitely will take this back to the team and continue to talk about it. We can't force her to go, which is hard, but we'll definitely continue to look at our resources for her.
Jazz and Kiara say their goodbyes, head back to the van. It's time to return to Macro Base and write their reports. They'll need to discuss the case of the woman on the porch with the rest of the team.
And what's the best case scenario, do you think, for her?
I think the best case scenario for her would be... First of all, substance use treatment. And then if there is a mental health issue, treat it, keep up with medications and... Yeah. Regular visits.
Like, she needs like a nurse to help, like a case manager, like an in-house potential nurse and case management. But then it's like you have and a psychiatrist, because you have to get down to the nitty and gritty as to why she's trying to start fires. Because if you put her in housing, is she going to burn her house down?
That best case scenario requires consent, and they don't have it, which leaves them, the woman on the porch, her neighbours, all in limbo. Macro is working with the woman's family and the landlord to resolve the situation peacefully, but there's always a risk the police could be called. And at that point, it's out of Macro's hands. And this is the tricky part for Macro. It's hard to thread the needle of respecting bodily autonomy while making sure that public safety isn't sacrificed. And there's already boundaries around what Macro addresses. Suicides, any situation with violence or weapons, they're not for Macro. In the case of Miles Hall, if Walnut Creek had had a Macro, on that final terrible day, the police may still have come to find him. The difference might have been that, along the way, there may have been a few more layers of support. Maybe a few more people for Tawn to call when she saw Miles deteriorating. I spoke to the Macro program manager, Jazz and Kiara's boss, about the case of the woman on the porch. He pointed to the systemic failures that led to this moment, and to the lack of mental health resources in California overall, thanks to historic cuts at state and federal level. But he made it clear, Macro is an attempt to build something where things have been cut before, and it needed to be trusted by the people using it, so force wasn't an option. One of the criticisms from activists about Macro has also been that it's still connected to the 911 number, a number that some people feel they can never call. For some, It's because of a time that they did call 911, expecting help, and got something very different.
Do you ever talk to him?
I do. Yeah, I do. I think I know that my husband does a lot.
He does?
Yeah, I think he has his own, you know, kind of, he's like, I talk to Miles every day. And
Tawn Hall's decision to dial 911 still haunts her. But then she shaped those feelings into action. When Miles died, Tawn said she wanted a different number, a different response. She would end up working with her local assemblywoman on a bill that, in California at least, could provide both. This bill proposed new ways to fund statewide crisis response units. The way to access them? By calling the new National Suicide and Mental Health Crisis Helpline that was rolled out in July this year, 988. The new funding would allow Californians access to a macro type system, but bigger. An integrated network of crisis intervention specialists, mobile teams of counselors, and peer support workers throughout California. Crucially, without calling 911.
So it's great to see, you know, that there's these cities that are kind of ahead of the times. But I just want to say with AB 988, what makes that legislation so important is that every county has to have this program. That's the difference. There's funding for that. So while Oakland worked really hard on their own city councils and their own local government to get that, now it could be available to all counties in the state.
Governor Newsom signed the bill at the end of September. So the new law plans an 8-year roadmap for rolling out the system statewide. The name of the new act? The Miles Hall Lifeline and Suicide Prevention Act. This episode was produced by me, Madeline Wood, and Vika Aronson. It was edited by Brenda Salinas-Baker. We got editorial guidance from Sasha Aslanian, and we had production assistance from Cameron Chertavian. Special thanks to Brad Milkey, Elliot Jones, Kat Brooks, Shannon Scully, Sergeant Doria Neff, Anne Janks, Michael Hunt, and Mason Holden. Josh Cohan is Director of Podcasts, and Liz Alessi is Director of Audio. Brad will be back on Monday. Thanks for listening.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table.
What is happening here?
It's just beautiful chaos.
Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view.
To be honest, I was thinking about asking him for a foot massage, and then I just froze.
This is the best gig on TV.
And you know, anything can happen.
That is what we do here.
I'm not going to lie, the chair's a little small for my behind.
The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.